Part 2. Community and Anarchy. Chapter 5. By fits and starts, the world entered a new age. The aliens benignly accepted a semi-divine mystique. Millennia fervor swept the system. Détente came into vogue. People began to speak, for the first time, of the Schismatrix, of a post-human solar system, diverse yet unified, where tolerance would rule and every faction would have a share. The aliens, they called themselves the investors, seemed unlimited in power. They were ancient, so old that they remembered no tradition earlier than starflight. Their mighty starships ranged a vast economic realm, buying and selling among 19 other intelligent races. Obviously, they possessed technology so potent that, if they chose, they could shatter the narrow world 100 times over. Humanity rejoiced that the aliens seemed so serenely affable. The goods they offered were almost always harmless, often artworks of vast academic interest and surprisingly small practicality. Human wealth poured into the alien coffers. Tiny embassies traveled to the stars in investor ships. They failed to accomplish much, and they remained tiny, because the investors charged fares that were astronomical. The investors recycled the riches they tapped from the human economy. They bought into human enterprises. With a single technological novelty from one of their packed holds, the aliens could transform a flagging industry into a rocketing growth stock. Factions competed wildly for their favor, and uncooperative worlds soon learned how easily they could be outflanked and rendered obsolete. Trade flourished in the new investor peace. Open warfare became vulgar, replaced by the polite covertness of rampant industrial espionage. With each new year, a golden age seemed just out of reach, and the years passed and passed. Goldreich Tremaine Council State, 3-4-37. The crowd pleased Lindsay. People filled the air around him, colored jackets with a froth of lace, legs in patterned stockings with sleek five-toed foot gloves. The air in the theater lobby reeked of Shaper perfumes. Lindsay lounged against one patterned velvet wall, his jacketed elbow hooked through a mooring loop. He dressed in the cutting edge of fashion, sea-green brocade jacket, green satin knee-longs, stockings pinstriped in yellow. His feet were elegantly gloved for free fall. A gold-chained video monocle gleamed in his waistcoat. Braids interlaced with yellow cord bound his long, graying hair. Lindsay was 51. Among the Shapers, he passed for one much older, some genetic from the dawn of Shaper history. There were many such in Goldreich Tremaine, one of the oldest Shaper city-states in the rings of Saturn. A mechanist emerged into the lobby from the theater. He wore a ribbed one-piece suit in tasteful mahogany brown. He noticed Lindsay and kicked off from the doorway, floating toward him. Lindsay reached out in friendly fashion and stopped the man's momentum. Beneath his sleeve, Lindsay's prosthetic right arm whined slightly with the movement.
"Good evening, Mr. Bayer."
The handsome mechanist nodded and took a mooring loop.
"Good evening, Dr. Mavrides. Always a pleasure."
Bayer was with the Ceres Legation. He was Undersecretary for Cultural Affairs, a colorless title meant to camouflage his affiliation with mech intelligence.
"I don't often see you during this day shift, Mr. Bayer."
"I'm slumming," Bayer said comfortably. Life in Goldreich Tremaine ran around the clock. The graveyard shift, from midnight to 8, was the loosest and least policed. A mechanist could mingle during the graveyard shift without attracting stares.
"Are you enjoying the play, sir?"
"A triumph. As good as Reumann, I'd say. This author, Ferdinand Vetterling, his work is new to me."
"He's a local youngster, one of our best."
"Ah, one of your protégés. I appreciate his détentiste sentiments. We're having a little soirée at the embassy later this week. I'd like to meet Mr. Vetterling, to express my admiration."
Lindsay smiled evasively.
"You're always welcome at my home, Mr. Bayer. Nora speaks of you often."
"How flattering. Colonel Dr. Mavrides is a charming hostess."
Bayer hid his disappointment, but his kinesics showed signs of impatience. Bayer wanted to leave, to
to touch base with some other social doyen. Lindsay bore him no resentment for it. It was the man's job. Lindsay himself held a rank in security. He was Captain Dr. Abelard Mavrides, an instructor in investor sociology at Goldreich Tremaine Cosmosity. Even in these days of the investor peace, a rank in security was mandatory for those in the Shaper academic military complex. Lindsay played the game, as they all did. In his role as theatrical manager, Lindsay never alluded to his rank, but Bayer was well aware of it, and only the grease of diplomatic politesse allowed them to be friends. Bayer's light blue eyes scanned the crowded lobby, and his face stiffened. Lindsay followed the man's gaze. Bayer had spotted someone. Lindsay sized the man up at once. A microphone lip bead, ear clasp audiophones, clothing that lacked finesse. A bodyguard, and not a shaper. The man's hair was sleeked back with antiseptic oils, and his face lacked shaper symmetry. Lindsay reached for his video monocle, fitted it to his right eye, and began filming. Bayer noticed the gesture and smiled with a hint of sourness.
"There are four of them," he said. "Your production has attracted a man of distinction."
"They look like concatenates," Lindsay said.
"A state visit," Bayer said.
"He is here incognito. It's the head of state from the Mare Serenitatis Republic, Chairman Philip Corey Constantine." Lindsay turned aside. "I don't know the gentleman."
"He is not a friend of detente," Bayer said. "I know him only by reputation. I can't introduce you."
Lindsay moved along the wall, keeping his back to the crowd.
"I must visit my office. Will you join me for a smoke?"
"Lung smoking?" Bayer said. "I never acquired the habit."
"Then you must excuse me." Lindsay fled.
"After 20 years, said Nora Mavrides.
She sat before her console, her security jacket thrown carelessly over her shoulders, a black cape over her amber-colored blouse.
"What's possessed him?" Lindsay demanded. "Isn't the Republic enough for him?"
Nora thought aloud.
"The militants must have brought him here. They need him to back their cause here in the capital. He has prestige, and he's no detente east."
"That's plausible," Lindsay said. "But only if you turn it around. The militants think Constantine is their pet unplanned, their loyal general. But they don't know his ambitions, or his potential. He's manipulated them."
"Did he see you?"
"I don't think so. I don't think he would have recognized me if he had." Lindsay stuck his spoon moodily into a carton of medicinal yogurt. "My age disguises me."
"My heart sank when I saw the film from your monocle. Abelard, these years, they've been so good to us. If he knew who you were, he could ruin us."
"Not completely." Lindsay forced himself to eat, grimacing. The yogurt was a special preparation for non-shapers whose intestines had been rendered antiseptic. It was bitter with digestive enzymes. "Constantine could denounce me, but what if he does? We'd still have the aliens. The investors don't give a damn about my genetics, my training. The aliens could be our refuge."
"We should attack Constantine. He's a killer."
"We're not the ones to talk on that score, darling." Lindsay gripped the carton with his mechanical hand. Its thin walls buckled precisely. "I always meant to avoid him if I could. It was something I fell into, a roll of the dice."
"Don't talk that way, as if it were something we can't help."
Lindsay drummed his iron fingers. Even the arm was part of his disguise. The antique prosthetic had once belonged to the Chief Justice, and Lindsay's affectation of it hinted at great age. On the wall of Nora's office, a huge satellite telephoto of the Saturnian surface crawled slowly, red winds interlacing streams of muddy gold. "We could leave," Lindsay said. "There are other council states. Kirkwood Gap's all right. Cassini Cluster."
"And give up everything we've built here?"
Lindsay watched the screen abstractly.
"You're all I want."
"I want that tenure, Abelard. That colonel professorship. If we go, what about the children? What about our clique? They depend on us."
"You're right. This is our home."
"You're making too much of this. Nora said. He'll return to the Republic soon. If Goldreich Tremaine weren't the capital now, he wouldn't be here.
Children laughed in the next room. From her console, Nora turned down the audio. Lindsay said, There's a horror between Philip and myself. We know too much about each other.
Don't be a fatalist, darling. I'm not going to sit with folded hands while some unplanned upstart attacks my husband.
Nora left her console and walked across to him. A centrifugal half-gravity tugged at her skirt and sleeve laces. Lindsay pulled her into his lap and ran his human hand across the serpentine curls of her hair.
Let him be, Nora. Otherwise it will come to killing again.
She kissed him.
You were alone in the past. Now you're a match for him. We have our midnight clique. We have the Mavridis line, the investors, my rank and security. We have our good trust. This life belongs to us.
Goldreich Tremaine Council State, 13437. Philip Constantine watched his ship's departure through his video monocle. The monocle pleased him. He liked its stylishness. Constantine took pains to stay abreast of such developments. Fashions were powerful manipulations, especially among the reshaped. Behind his ship, the Friendship Serene, the Goldreich Tremaine complex spun in gyroscopic counterclockwork. Constantine studied the city's image, broadcast to his monocle from a camera mounted on the ship's hull. The orbiting city taught an object lesson in shaper history. Its core was the dark, heavily shielded cylinder that had sheltered the earliest settlers. Desperate pioneers, driven to mine the rings of Saturn despite their sleets of radiation and complex electrical storms. The central core of Goldreich Tremaine was as dark as a nut, a stubborn acorn that had endured and broken forth at last into fantastic growth. Hubbed spheres wheeled about it. Radar installations slid with sleek precision on external tracks. Two huge tubed suburbs turned in counterbalanced array on white ceramic stems, and all about the inner complex was a lacy network of habitats in freefall. Outside the bubbled suburbs, the subbles, loomed the immaterial walls of the bottle. The Friendship Serene hit the flaw in the bottle. Colored static raced across Constantine's monocle, and Goldreich Tremaine disappeared. It was visible now only by its absence, a lozenge of dark fog in the white ice rubble of the ring. The dark fog was the bottle itself, a magnetic tokamak field 8 kilometers long, shielding the Shaper city-state within a fusion-powered web. This far from the sun, solar kilowatts were useless. The reshaped had their own suns, bright fusion cores in every council state. Goldreich Tremaine, Dermot Gold Murray, Torrey Phase, Kirkwood Gap, Synchronous, Cassini Cluster, Encke Cluster, Skimmers Union, Arsenal. Constantine knew them all. Ghost acceleration wafted across him as the engines cut in. The Goldreich Tremaine weather station had cleared them for launch. There was no chance of a crippling ring lightning strike. Background radiation was light. With the new Shaper drives, he faced mere weeks of travel. The playwright Zeuner entered the cabin and seated himself beside Constantine.
It's gone, he said.
Homesick already, Carl?
Constantine looked up at the larger man.
For Goldreich Tremaine? Yes. For the people, that's another matter.
Some day you'll return in triumph.
Very kind of you to say so, Your Excellency.
Zeuner ran one fawn-colored glove over his chin. Constantine noted that the Republic standard bacteria were already spotting the man's neck.
Forget titles of state, Constantine said. In the Ring Council, it's politesse. In the Republic, it smacks of aristocracy. Our local form of bad ideology.
I see, Dr. Constantine. I'll be more careful in the future.
Zeuner's clean-shaven face had the anonymous beauty of the reshaped. He dressed with fussy precision in understated browns and beiges. Constantine tucked the monocle into his copper-threaded velvet waistcoat. Beneath his embroidered linen jacket, his back had begun to sweat. The skin of his back was peeling where the rejuvenation virus ate at aging cells.
For 20 years the infestation had wandered over his body, the first reward for his loyalty to the Shaper cause. Where the virus had worked, his olive skin had a child's smoothness. Zoyner examined the cabin walls. The heavy insulation was stitched with pointillistic tapestries depicting the Republic. Orchards spread under bright clouds. Sunlight fell with cathedral-like solemnity across golden wheat fields. Ultralight aircraft dipped over stone-walled mansions with red-tiled roofs. The vistas were as clean as a travel brochure's. Zoyner said,
"What's it really like, your Republic?"
"A backwater," Constantine said. "An antique. Before our revolution, the Republic was rotting. Not just socially, physically. An ecosystem that large needs total genetic control. But the builders didn't care about the long run. In the long run, they were all dead." Constantine steepled his fingers. "Now we inherit their mess. The concatenation exiled its visionaries. Their genetics theorists, for instance, who formed the Ring Council. The concatenates were squeamish. Now they have lost all power. They are client states."
"You think we'll win, Doctor? The Shapers?"
"Yes." Constantine gave the man one of his rare smiles. "Because we understand what this struggle is about. Life. I don't mean that the mechs will be annihilated. They may totter on for whole centuries. But they will be cut off. They'll be cybernetic, not living flesh. That's a dead end, because there's no will behind it. No imperatives. Only programming. No imagination." The playwright nodded.
"Sound ideology. Not like what you hear in Goldreich Tremaine these days. Detentist slogans. Unity in diversity, where all the factions form one vast schismatrix. Humankind reuniting when faced by aliens."
Constantine shifted in his chair, surreptitiously rubbing his back against the cushion. "I've heard that rhetoric. On the stage. This producer you were mentioning."
"Mavridis?" Zoyner was eager. "They're a powerful clan. Goldreich Tremaine, Jastrow Station, Kirkwood Gap. They've never had a genetic on the council itself, but they share genes with the Gazas and the Drapers and the Vetterlings. The Vetterlings have authority."
"This man is a Mavridis by marriage, you said. A non-genetic."
"A eunuch, you mean? Yes, he's not allowed to contribute his genes to the line."
Zoyner was pleased to tell this bit of scandal.
"He's also an investor, pet. And a Cepheid."
"Cepheid? You mean he has rank in security?"
"He's Captain Dr. Abelard Mavridis, C.Ph.D. It's a low rank for one so old. He was a sundog once. A cometary miner, they say. He met the aliens on the rim of the system, wormed his way into their good graces somehow. They'd been here only a few months when they brought Mavridis and his wife into Goldreich Tremaine in one of their starships. Since then, he's moved from success to success. Corporations hire him as a go-between with the aliens. He teaches investor studies and speaks their language fluently. He's wealthy enough to keep his past obscure."
"Old line Shapers guard their privacy closely." Zoyner brooded.
"He's my enemy. He blighted my career."
Constantine thought it through. He knew more about Mavridis than Zoyner did. He had recruited Zoyner deliberately, knowing that Mavridis must have enemies, and that finding them was easier than creating them. Zoyner was frustrated. His first play had failed. The second was never produced. He was not privy to the behind-the-scenes machinations of Mavridis and his midnight clique. Zoyner was harshly anti-mechanist. His gene line had suffered cruelly in the war. The Detentists rejected him. So Constantine had charmed him. He had lured Zoyner to the Republic with promises of the theatrical archives, a living tradition of drama that Zoyner could study and exploit. The Shaper was grateful, and because of that gratitude, he was Constantine's pawn. Constantine was silent. Mavridis troubled him. Tentacles of the man's influence had spread throughout Goldreich Tremaine. and the coincidences went beyond chance. They hinted at a deliberate plot. A man who chose to call himself Abelard, an impresario of the theater, staging political plays, and his wife was a diplomat. At least Constantine knew that Abelard Lindsay was dead. His agents in the Zaibatsu had taped Lindsay's death at the hands of the Geisha Bank. Constantine had even spoken to the woman who had had Lindsay killed, a Shaper renegade called Kitsune. He had the whole sorry story. Lindsay's involvement with pirates, his desperate murder of the Geisha Bank's former leader. Lindsay had died horribly. But why had Constantine's first assassin never reported back from the Zaibatsu? He had not thought the man would turn sundog. Assassins had failsafes implanted. Few traitors survived. For years, Constantine had lived in fear of his lost assassin. The elite of the Ring Council's security assured him that the assassin was dead. Constantine did not believe them, and had never trusted them again. For years, he had worked his way into the mirrored underworld of Shaper covert action. Assassins and bodyguards, the two were often one and the same, since they specialized in one another's tradecraft, these had become his closest allies. He knew their subterfuges, their fanatic loyalties. He struggled constantly to win their trust. He sheltered them in his republic, hiding them from pacifist persecution. He used his prestige freely to further their militarist ends. Some Shapers still despised him for his unplanned genes. From many others, he had won respect. Personal hatreds did not bother him, but it bothered him that he might be cut short before he had measured himself against the world, before he had satisfied the soaring ambition that had driven him since childhood. Who knew about Lindsay, the only man who had ever been his friend? When he was young and weaker, before the armor of distrust had sealed around him, Lindsay had been his intimate. Who let this phantom loose, and to what end? Goldreich Tremaine Council State, 26-12-46. Wedding guests surrounded the garden. From his hiding place behind the boughs of a dwarf magnolia, Lindsay saw his wife lightly bounding toward him in half a gravity. Green fronds brushed at the spreading wings of her headdress. Nora's formal gown was a dense ochre weave beaded in silver, with openwork amber sleeves.
"You're all right, darling?"
Lindsay said. "My sleeve hems, burn it. I was dancing and popped a whole weave loose."
"I saw you leave. Do you need help?"
"I can get it." Lindsay struggled with the complex interweave. "I'm slow, but I can do it."
"Let me help."
She stepped to his side, pulled inlaid knitting needles from her headdress, and tatted his sleeves with a smooth dexterity he could not hope to match. He sighed and tucked his own needles carefully back into his braids.
"The regent is asking about you," she said. "The senior genetics are here."
"Where'd you put them?"
"In the veranda, discreet. I had to clear out a raft of kids."
She finished the sleeve.
"There, good enough."
"You're a wonder."
"No kissing, Abelard. You'll smear your makeup. After the party," she smiled. "You look grand."
Lindsay ran his mechanical hand over his coils of gray hair. The steel knuckles glittered with inlaid seed gems. The wire tendons sparkled with interwoven strands of fiber optics. He wore a formal Goldreich Tremaine Cosmosity Academics ruffled overvest, its lapels studded with pins of rank. His knee-longs were a rich coffee brown. Brown stockings relieved the dignity of his outfit with a hint of iridescence.
"I danced with the bride," he said. "I think I surprised them a bit."
"I heard the shouts, dear."
She smiled and took his arm, placing her hand on his sleeve above the steel of his artificial ulna. They left the garden. On the patio outside, the bride and groom were dancing on the ceiling, heads downward. Their feet darted nimbly in and out of the dance rig, a broad complex of padded foot loops for use in light gravity. Lindsay watched the bride, feeling a rush of happiness close to pain. Cleo Mavridis. The young bride was the dead woman's clone, sharing her name and her genes. There were times when Lindsay felt that behind the merry eyes of the younger Cleo, there lurked an older spirit, as a sound might still vibrate in the glass of a crystal just after it had ceased to ring. He had done what he could. Since her production, the younger Cleo had been his special care. He and Nora found satisfaction in these amends. It was more than penance. They had taken too many pains to call it simply recompense. It was love. The groom danced powerfully. He had the bear-like build of all the Vetterling genetics. Fernand Vetterling was a gifted man, a standout, even in a society of genius. Lindsay had known the man for 20 years as playwright, architect, and clique member. Vetterling's creative energy still filled Lindsay with a kind of awe, even subdued fear. How long would the marriage last, he wondered, between Cleo and her fleet graces and the sober Vetterling, with his mind like a sharp steel axe? It was a marriage of state as well as a love match. Much capital had been invested in it, economic and genetic. Nora led him on through a crowd of children who were lashing speed into whirring gyroscopes with dainty braided whips. As usual, Paolo Mavridis was winning, his 9-year-old face alight with preternatural concentration.
"Don't hit my wheel, Nora," he said. "Paolo's been gambling," said Randa Vetterling, a muscular 6-year-old. She grinned mischievously, showing missing front teeth.
"Nya,"
Paolo said, not looking up.
"Randa's an informer."
"Play nicely," Nora said. "Don't bother the seniors." The senior genetics were sitting around the bull table in Lindsay's veranda, with its investor centerpiece. They were conversing strictly in looks, a language which to the untrained eye seemed to consist entirely of sidelong glances. Lindsay, nodding, glanced under the table. 2 children were squatting beneath it, playing in tandem with a long loop of string. Using all 4 hands and their largest toes, they had formed a complex rack of angles.
"Very nice," Lindsay said. "But go play your spider games elsewhere."
"All right,"
the older child said grudgingly. Careful not to disturb their structure, they wormed their way toward the open doorway on their heels and toes, their string-wrapped hands outspread.
"I gave them some candy," said Diedrich Ross when they had left. "They said they'd save it for later. Ever hear of kids that age saving candy for later? What the hell's becoming of the world?"
Lindsay sat down, opening a pocket mirror. He pulled a powder puff from the pocket of his vest.
"Sweating like a pig," Ross observed. "You're not the man you once were, Mavridis."
"You can talk when you've danced 4 measures, Ross, you old fraud," Lindsay said.
"Margaret has a new opinion on your centerpiece," said Charles Vetterling.
The former regent had gone frankly to seed since his loss of office. He looked tubby and choleric, his old-fashioned trimmed hair speckled with white. Lindsay was interested.
"What's that, Madam Chancellor?"
"It's erotica,"
Chancellor General Margaret Giuliano leaned over the inlaid table and pointed into the Perspex pressure dome. Beneath the dome was a complex sculpture. Speculation had been rife ever since the investors had first given it to Lindsay. The gift was carved out of water ice and plated in glimmering frozen ammonia. Machinery beneath the dome maintained it at 40 degrees Kelvin. The sculpture consisted of 2 oblate lumps covered in filigree spires of delicate crystalline frost. The tableau was set on a rippled surface, possibly meant to represent some unimaginably cold sludge ocean. Off to one side, poking through the surface, was a smaller hinged lump that might have been an elbow.
"You'll notice there are 2 of them, the shaper academic said. "I believe that the physical goings-on are tastefully concealed beneath the water. The fluid, rather."
"They don't look much alike," Lindsay said. "It seems more likely that one is eating the other, if they're alive at all."
"That's what I said,"
rasped Sigmund Fetzko. The mechanist renegade, by far the oldest of the 6 of them, lay back in his chair in exhaustion. Words came to him with difficulty, propelled by flexing rib braces beneath his heavy coat.
"The second one has dimples, shell collapsing, juice sucked out of it."
A Vetterling child came into the room, chasing a runaway gyroscope. Vetterling looked at Neville Pongpianskul, changing the subject. The child left.
"It is a good marriage,"
Pong Pian School replied.
Mavridi's grace with Vetterling determination. A formidable match. Michaela Vetterling shows promise, I think. What was her split?
Vetterling was smug.
60 Vetterling, 30 Mavridis, and 10% Garza, on a general reciprocity deal. But I saw to it that the Garza genes were close to early line Vetterling. None of that new line Garza tampering. Not till there's proof behind it.
Young Adelaide Garza is brilliant, said Margaret Giuliano. One of my advanced students. The super brights are astounding, Regent. A quantum leap.
She smoothed the lapel of her metal-studded overvest with graceful, wrinkled hands.
Really? Said Ross. I was married to the older Adelaide once.
What happened to Adelaide? Said Pong Pian School.
Ross shrugged.
Faded.
A faint chill crossed the room. Lindsay changed the subject. We're planning a new veranda. Nora needs this one for her office.
She needs a bigger place, said Pong Pian School.
Lindsay nodded. 10 year, and this is our best discreet. Wakefield Zaibatsu did the debugging. Otherwise, we have to have the debuggers in again. It'll turn the place upside down.
Building on credit, Ross said.
Of course, Lindsay smiled.
Too flaming much loose credit in GT these days, Ross said. I don't hold with it.
Ah, Ross, Vetterling said. You haven't changed those digs of yours in 80 years. A man can't turn sideways in those core rat holes. Take us Vetterlings now. The bridegroom just delivered us the specs for a new complex of inflatables.
Jerry-built crap, Ross opined. GT's too crowded these days anyway. Too many young sharks. Things smell good now, but there's crash in the air, I can feel it. When it comes, I'll pull up stakes and head for the commentaries. Been too long since I last tested my luck.
Pong Pian School looked at Lindsay, communicating in the set of his wrinkled eyelids his amused contempt for Ross's incessant luck-bragging. Ross had made his big mining strike a century ago, and had never let anyone forget it. Though he incessantly goaded others on, Ross's own risk-taking was confined almost entirely to his odd choice of waistcoats.
"I have a clique candidate," Vetterling said. "Very polite, very well-spoken. Carl Zoyner."
"The playwright," said Margaret Giuliano. "I don't care for his work."
"You mean he's not a detentiste," Vetterling said. He doesn't fit your pacifism, Margaret. Mavridis, I believe you know the man.
We've met, Lindsay said.
Zoyner's a fascist, said Pong Pian School.
The topic galvanized the elderly doctor. He leaned forward intently, nodding his hands.
He's Philip Constantine's man. He spent years in the Republic. A playground for Shaper imperialists.
Vetterling frowned.
Calm yourself, Neville. I know the concatenation. I was born there. Constantine's work there should have been done 100 years ago.
You mean fill his garden world with broken-down assassins?
To bring a new world into the Shaper community.
Nothing but cultural genocide.
Pong Pian School had been rejuvenated. His lean body quivered with unnatural energy. Lindsay had never asked what technique he used. It left his skin smooth but leathery, and of a peculiar dusky color not found in nature. His knuckles were so heavily wrinkled that they looked like small rosettes.
The Circumlunar Republic should be left as a cultural museum. It's good policy. We need variety. Not every society we form can hold together.
Neville, Sigmund Fetzko spoke heavily. You are talking as if you were a boy.
Pong Pian School leaned back.
I confess I've been reading my old speeches since my last rejuve.
That's what's got you purged, Vetterling said.
My taste for antiquities. My own speeches are antiques by now, but the issue is still with us, friends. Community and anarchy. Politics pulls things together. technology blows them apart. Little enclaves like the Republic should be preserved intact, so that if our own tempering strikes us down, there'll be someone left to pick up the pieces.
There's the Earth, said Fetsko.
I draw the line at barbarians, Pong Pianskul said. He sipped his drink, a tranquilizer frappe.
If you had any guts, Pong Pianskul, Ross said, you'd go to the Republic and tackle things firsthand.
Pong Pianskul sniffed.
I'll wager I could gather damning evidence there.
Nonsense, said Vetterling. A wager?
Ross looked from one to the other.
Let me be the arbiter, then. Doctor, if you could find evidence that would offend my hardened sensibilities, we would all agree that right is on your side.
Pong Pianskul hesitated.
It's been so long since I...
Ross laughed.
Afraid? Better hang back and cultivate your mystique, then. You need a facade of mystery, otherwise the young sharks will have you for breakfast.
There were breakfasters after the purge, Pong Pianskul said. They couldn't digest me.
That was 2 centuries back, Ross taunted. I recall a certain episode.
What was it?
Immortality from kelp.
What?
Pong Pianskul blinked. Then the memory seemed to ooze up within him, buried under decades.
Kelp, he said. The Earth Ocean Wonder Plant.
He was quoting himself.
You wonder, friends, why your catalytic balances vary. The answer is kelp, the sea-born wonder plant, now genetically altered to grow and flourish in the primeval brine from which blood itself derives. My God, I'd forgotten entirely.
He sold kelp pills, Ross confided. Had a little dig in some inflatable slum. Radiation so hard you could poach an egg against the bulkhead.
Placebos, Pong Pianskul said. Goldreich Tremaine was full of old, unplanned types then. Miners, refugees cooked by radiation. It was before the bottle shielded us. If they looked hopeless, I used to slip a little painkiller into the mix.
You don't get as old as we are without artifice, Lindsay said. Vetterling snorted.
Don't start reminiscing, Mavridis. I want to know what my angle is, Ross. What are my winnings once Pong Pianskul fails?
My domicile, Pong Pianskul said. In the Fitzgerald wheel.
Vetterling's eyes widened.
Against?
Against your public denunciation of Constantine and Zoina, and the expenses of the trip. Your beautiful place, Margaret Giuliano told Pong Pianskul. How can you part with it, Neville?
Pong Pianskul shrugged.
If the future belongs to Constantine's friends, then I don't care to live here.
Don't forget you've just had a treatment, Vetterling said uncomfortably. You're acting rashly. I hate to turn a man out of his digs. We can put the bet off until...
Off? Pong Pianskul said. That's our curse. There's always time for everything, while those younger than ourselves tear into every year as if there were no yesterday. No, I'm settled, Regent.
He extended his leathery hand to Vetterling.
Fire,
Vetterling said. He took Pong Pianskul's thin hand in his heavy one.
Sealed, then. The four of you are witnesses.
I'll take the next chip out, said Pong Pianskul.
He stood up, his verdigris-colored eyes gleaming feverishly.
I must make arrangements. A delightful little fete, Mavridis.
Lindsay was startled. Oh, thank you, sir. The robot has your hat, I think.
I must thank my hostess.
Pong Pianskul left.
He's cracked, Vetterling said. That new treatment's unhinged him. Poor Pong Pianskul never was very stable. What treatment is he using?
Fetsko wheezed.
He seems so energetic.
Ross smiled.
an unproven one. He can't afford a registered treatment. I hear he's made an arrangement with a wealthier man to serve as test subject. They split the cost.
Lindsay looked at Ross. Ross hid his expression by biting into a canapé.
A risk, said Fetsko. That's why the young ones bear us, so that we can take their risks and weed out bad treatments with our casualties.
Could have been worse, Ross said. He could have fallen for one of those skin virus scams. He'd be peeling like a snake right now, ha!
Young Paolo Mavridis stepped through the soundproof field in the doorway.
Nora says come see Cleo and Mr. Vetterling off.
Thank you, Paolo. Giuliano and the Regent Vetterling headed for the doorway, small-talking about construction costs. Fetsko tottered after them, his legs buzzing audibly. Ross took Lindsay by the arm.
A moment, Abelard.
Yes, Arts Lieutenant?
It's not security business, Abelard. You won't tell Giuliano that I put Pong Pian School up to it?
The unproven treatment, you mean? No, it was cruel, though. Ross smirked.
Look, I almost married Margaret a few decades back, and from what Neville tells me, my marrying days may be back any day now. Listen, Mavridis, it hasn't escaped me the way you've been looking these past few years. Frankly, you're in decay.
Lindsay touched his graying hair. You're not the first to say so.
It's not a money problem.
No, he sighed. I don't want my genetics inspected. There are too many security groups watching, and frankly, I'm not all I seem.
Who the hell is at this age? Listen, Mavridis, I figured it was something like that, you being eunuch. That's my point. I've gotten wind of something very quiet, very confidential. It costs, but there's no questions asked, no records. Operations take place in a discreet, out in one of the dog towns.
I see, Lindsay said. Risky. Ross shrugged.
You know I don't get along with the rest of my gene line. They won't give me their records. I have to handle my own research. Can't we work something out?
Possibly. I have no secrets from my wife. May she know?
Surely, surely. You'll do it?
I'll be in touch. Lindsay put his prosthetic arm on Ross's shoulder. Ross shuddered, just a little. The wedding couple had made it as far as the alcove, where they had bogged down in a crowd of well-wishers and hat-fetching junior genetics. Lindsay embraced Cleo and took Fernand Vetterling's arm left-handed.
You'll take good care of my sib, Fernand? You know she's very young.
Fernand met his eyes.
She's life and breath to me, friend.
That's the spirit. We'll put the new play off a while. Love is more important. Nora kissed Fernand, smearing his makeup. Back within the domicile, the younger set were hitting full stride. The dancing across the ceiling footloops had degenerated into a near brawl, where young shapers, screaming with laughter, struggled to shove one another off the crowded dance rig. Several had fallen already and were clinging to others, dangling loosely in the half-gravity. High spirits, Lindsay thought. Soon many of these would be married as well. Few would find the convenient meshing of love and politics that Fernand had. They were pawns in the dynastic games of their seniors, where money and genetics set the rules. He looked over the crowd with the close judgment that 30 years of Shaper audiences had taught him. Some were hidden by the trees of the garden, a central rectangle of lush greenery surrounded by tessellated patio floors. 4 Mavridis children were tormenting one of the serving robots, which wouldn't spill its drinks, though they tugged it and tripped it up. Lindsay leaped upward in the mild gravity to look past the garden. An argument was brewing on the other side, 6 shapers surrounding a man in black coveralls. Trouble. Lindsay walked to the garden roofway and leaped up onto the ceiling.
He pulled himself across the pathway with the ease of long habit, clinging deftly to knobs and foot niches. He was forced to pause as a pack of three children raced past and over him, giggling excitedly. His sleeve lace came loose again. Lindsay dropped to the floor on the other side.
"Burn the sleeves," he muttered.
By now everyone looked a little unraveled. He made his way toward the cluster of debaters. A young mechanist stood at the circle's center, wearing well-cut satin overalls with black frogging and a suggestion of shaper lace at the throat. Lindsay recognized him. A disciple of Ryumen's, come in with the latest Kabuki intrasolar tour. He called himself Wells. Wells had a brash, sundogish look, short matted hair, shifty eyes, a wide freefall stance. He had the Kabuki mask logo on his coveralls shoulders. He looked drunk.
"It's an open and shut case," Wells insisted loudly. "When they used the investors as a pretext to stop the war, that was one thing. But those of us who've known the aliens since we were children can recognize the truth. They're not saints. They have played on us for profit."
The group had not yet noticed Lindsay. He hung back, judging their kinesics. This was grim. The shapers were Afriel, Besetzny, Warden, Parr, and Lang, his graduate class in alien linguistics. They listened to the mechanist with polite contempt. Obviously, they had not bothered to tell him who they were, though their pre-doctoral overvests marked their rank clearly.
"You don't feel they bear any credit for the détente?"
This was Simon Afriel, a cold and practiced young militant already making his mark in the Shaper academic military complex. He had confessed once to Lindsay that he had his sights set on an alien diplomatic assignment. So did they all. Surely, out of 19 known alien races, there would be one with which the Shapers could establish strong rapport, and the diplomat who returned sane from that assignment would have the world at his feet.
"I'm an ardent detentiste," said Wells. "I just want humanity to share the profit from it. For 30 years, the investors have bought and sold us. Do we have their secrets? Their star drive? Their history? No. Instead, they fob us off with toys and expensive joyrides to the stars. These scaly con artists have preyed on human weakness and division. I'm not alone in thinking this. There's a new generation in the cartels these days."
"What's the point?"
This was Besetzny, a wealthy young woman who already spoke 8 languages as well as investor. She was the picture of young Shaper glamour in her slashed cordless sleeves and winged velvet headdress.
"In the cartels, you're outnumbered by your old. They'll deal with us as they always have. That's their routine. Without the investors to shield us..."
"That's just it, Dr. Designate."
Wells was not as drunk as he looked.
"There are hundreds of us who long to see the rings for what they are. You're not without your admirers, you know. We have third-hand ring fashions, fourth-hand ring art, passed around secretly. It's pathetic. We have so much to offer each other. But the investors have squeezed everything they can from the status quo. Already they've begun abetting warmongers, cutting down ring cartel interflights, encouraging bidding wars. You know, the mere fact that I've come here is enough to brand me for life, possibly even as an agent for ring security. A bacillus, I think they call them. I'll never set foot in a cartel again without eyes watching me."
Afria lifted his voice.
"Good evening, Captain Doctor."
He had spotted Lindsay. Making the best of it, Lindsay ambled forward.
"Good evening, Doctor's Designate, Mr. Wells. I trust you're not embittering yourselves with youthful cynicism. This is a happy time."
But now Wells was nervous. All mechanists were terrified of agents of ring security, not realizing that the academic military complex permeated Shaper life so thoroughly that a quarter of the population was security in one form or another. Besetzny, Afriel, and Parr, for instance, all ardent leaders in Gold Reich Tremaine paramilitary youth, were much more of a threat to Wells than Lindsay, with his reluctant captaincy. Wells, though, was galvanized with distrust. He mumbled pleasantries until Lindsay walked away.
The worst of it was that Wells was right. The Shaper students knew it, but they were not about to jeopardize their hard-won doctorates by publicly agreeing with a naive mech. No one would have Ring Council clearance to visit other stars without an impeccable ideology. Of course, the investors were profiteers. Their arrival had not brought the millennium humankind had expected. The investors were not even particularly intelligent. They made up for that with a cast-iron gall and a magpie's lust for shiny loot. They were simply too greedy to become confused. They knew what they wanted, and that was their critical advantage. They had been painted much larger than life. Lindsay had done as much himself when he and Nora had parlayed their asteroid death trap into 3 months of language lessons and a free ride to the Ring Council. With his instant notoriety as a friend to aliens, Lindsay had done his best to inflate the investor mystique. He was as guilty of the fraud as anyone. He had even defrauded the investors. The investor's name for him was still a rasp and whistle, meaning artist. Lindsay still had friends among the investors, or at least beings whom he felt sure he could amuse. Investors had a sense of something close to humor, a certain sadistic enjoyment in a sharp deal. That sculpture they had given him, which rested in a place of honor in his home, might well be two frost-eaten chunks of alien dung. God only knew to what befuddled alien they had sold his own piece of found art. It was only to be expected that a young man like Wells would demand the truth and spread it, not knowing the consequences of his action, or even caring. Simply too young to live a lie. Well, the falsehoods would hold up a while longer, despite the new generation bred in the investor piece, who struggled to rip aside the veil, not knowing that it was the very canvas on which their world was painted. Lindsay looked for his wife. She was in her office, closeted with her conspirator's crew of trained diplomats. Colonel Professor Nora Mavridis cast a large shadow in Goldreich Tremaine. Sooner or later, every diplomat in the capital had drifted into it. She was the best known of her class's loyalists and served as their champion. Lindsay hid within the comfort of his own mystique. As far as he knew, he was the last survivor of the foreign section. If other non-Shaper diplomats survived, it was not by advertising themselves. He entered the room briefly for politeness' sake, but as usual, their smooth kinesics made him nervous. He left for the smoking room, where two stage-door hangers-on were being introduced to the modish vice by the cast of Vetterling's Shepherd Moons. Here, Lindsay sank at once into his role as impresario. They believed in what they saw of him. An older man, a bit slow, perhaps, without the fire of genius others had, but generous and with a tang of mystery. With that mystery came glamour. Dr. Abelard Mavridis had set his share of trends. He drifted from one conversation to another. Genetic marriage politics, ring security intrigues, city rivalries, academic doctrines, day shift clashes, artistic cliques. Threads all of a single fabric. The sheen of it, the smooth brilliance of its social design, had lulled him into routine. He wondered sometimes about the placidity he felt. How much of it was age, the mellowness of decay? Lindsay was 61. The wedding party was ending. Actors left to rehearse, seniors crept to their antique warrens, the hordes of children scampered to the creches of their gene line. Lindsay and Nora retired at last to their bedroom. Nora was bright-eyed, a little tipsy. She sat on the edge of their bed, unloosing the clasp at the back of her formal dress. She pulled it forward and the whole complex fretwork hissed loose across her back in a web of strings. Nora had had her first rejuvenation 20 years ago, at 38, and a second at 50. The skin of her shoulders was glassily smooth in the bedside lamp's roseate light. Lindsay reached into his bedside table's upper drawer and took his old video monocle from its padded box. Nora pulled her slim arms from the gown's beaded sleeves and reached up to unwire her hat. Lindsay began filming.
"You're not undressing?"
She turned.
"Abelard, what are you doing?"
"I want to remember you like this," he said.
this perfect moment. She laughed and threw the headdress aside. With a few deft movements, she yanked the jeweled pins from her hair and tossed loose a surge of dark braids. Lindsay was aroused. He put the monocle aside and slid out of his clothes. They made slow, comfortable love. Lindsay, though, had felt the sting of mortality that night, and it put a spur into him. Passion seized him. He made love with ardent urgency, and she responded. He climaxed hard, looking throughout the heartbeats of orgasm at his own iron hand on her sleek shoulder. He lay gasping, his heart beating loud in his ears. After a moment, he moved aside. She sighed, stretched, and laughed.
"Wonderful," she said. "I'm happy, Abelard."
"I love you, darling," he said. "You're my life." She leaned up on one elbow.
"You're all right, sweetheart?"
Lindsay's eyes were stinging. "I was talking with Diedrich Ross tonight," he said carefully. "He has a rejuving program he wants me to try."
"Oh," she said, delighted. "Good news."
"It's risky."
"Listen, darling, being old is risky. The rest of it is just a matter of tactics. All you need is some minor decatabolism. Any lab can handle that. You don't need anything ambitious. That can wait another 20 years.
"It'll mean dropping my mask to someone. Ross says this lot is discreet, but I don't trust Ross." Vetterling and Pong Pian School had a peculiar scene tonight. Ross abetted them. She unraveled one of her braids.
"You're not old, darling, and you've been pretending it too long. Your history won't be a problem much longer. The diplomats are winning their rights back, and you're a Mavridis now. Regent Vetterling's unplanned, and no one thinks less of him."
"Of course they do."
"Maybe a little. That's not it, though. That's not why you've put this off. Your eyes look puffy, Abelard. Have you been taking your antioxidants?"
Lindsay was silent a moment. He sat up in bed, propping himself up with his untiring prosthetic arm. "It's my mortality," he said. "It meant so much to me once. It's all I have left of my old life, my old convictions."
"But you're not staying the same by letting yourself age. You should stay young if you want to preserve your old feelings."
"There's only one way to do that. Vera Kellen's way." Her hand stopped with the braid half twisted. "I'm sorry," Lindsay said. "But it's there somewhere. The shadow. I'm afraid, Nora. If I'm young again, it will change things. All these years that there's been such joy for us. I froze here, lying in the shadows, safe with you and happy. To be young again, to take this risk, I'll be out in the open. Eyes will be watching." She caressed his cheek.
"Darling, I'll watch over you. I'll protect you. No one alive will hurt you without coming through me first."
"I know that, and I'm glad for it. But I can't shake off this feeling. Is it just guilt? Guilt that life has been good to us? That we've had love while those others died like rats in a corner?" His voice trembled. He looked at the sienna weave of the bedspread in the lamp's mild glow. "How long can the peace go on? The old despise us while the young see through us. Things must change, and how could they be better? It can only be worse for us, sweetheart." He met her eyes. "I remember the days when we had nothing, not even the air to breathe, and the rot crept in all around us. Everything we've gained since then has been sheer profit to us. But it's not been real. What's between us two is real, that's all. Tell me that if all this collapses, you'll still be with me." She took his hands, curling the iron one over her own.
"What's brought this on? Is it Constantine?"
"Vetterling wants to bring one of Constantine's men into the clique."
"Burn him! I knew that despot came into this somehow. He's what frightens you, isn't he?
stirring up old tragedies. I feel better now that I know who I'm facing. It's not just him, darling. Listen, Goldreich Tremaine can't stay on top forever. The investor peace is crumbling. It'll be open struggle again between Shaper and Mechanist. The military wing is bound to reassert itself. We'll lose the capital ship. This is pure alarm, Abelard. We haven't lost anything yet. The detentistes in GT have never been stronger. My diplomats... I know you're strong. You'll win, I think. But if you don't, if we have to sundog it... Sundog? We're not refugees, darling. We're Mavridi's genetics, with offices, property, tenure. This is our fortress. We can't just abandon this, when it's given us so much. You'll feel different after the treatment. When your youth is back, you'll see things differently. I know, Lindsay said. And it scares me. I love you, Abelard. Tell me you'll call Ross tomorrow. Oh no, Lindsay said. It would be a bad mistake to seem too eager. When, then? Oh, a few more years. That's nothing by Ross's standards. But, Abelard, it hurts me, watching age cut into you. It's gone far enough. It's just not reasonable. Her eyes filled with tears. Lindsay was startled and alarmed. Don't cry, Nora. You'll hurt yourself. He put his arms around her. She embraced him. Can't we keep what we have? You've made me doubt myself. I'm a fool, Lindsay said. I'm in good shape. There's no need to be rash. I'm sorry I've said all this. Her eyes were dry again. I'll win. We'll win. We'll be young and strong together. You'll see. Goldreich Tremaine Council State, 16-4-53. Lindsay had put off his meeting as long as possible. Now antioxidants and his special diet were no longer enough. He was 68. The demortalization clinic was in the outskirts of Goldreich Tremaine, part of the growing cluster of inflatable subbles. The tube-linked bubbles could mushroom or vanish overnight, a perfect habitat for black medicals and other dubious enclaves. Mechanists lurked here, hunting Shaper life extension while evading Shaper law. Supply and demand had conjured up corruption, while Goldreich Tremaine grew lax with success. The capital had overreached itself, and cracks in the economy were papered over with black money. Fear had driven Lindsay to this point, fear that things might fall apart and find him weak. Ross had promised him anonymity. He would be in and out in a hurry, 2 days at the most. I don't want anything major, Lindsay told the old woman. Just a decatabolism.
Did you bring your gene line records?
No.
That complicates matters.
The black market demortalist looked at him with an oddly girlish tilt of the head.
Genetics determine the nature of the side effects. Is that natural aging or cumulative damage?
It's natural.
Then we can try something less fine-tuned. Hormonals with a deoxidation flush for free radicals. Quick and dirty, but it'll bring your sparkle back.
Lindsay thought of Pong Pian School and his leathery skin. What treatment do you use yourself?
That's confidential.
How old are you? The woman smiled.
You shouldn't pry, friend. The less we know about each other, the better.
Lindsay gave her a look. She failed to catch it. He looked again. She didn't know the language. He crawled with unease. I can't go through with this, he said. I find you too hard to trust. Lindsay floated toward the bubble's exit, away from its free-fall core of hospital scanners and samplers.
Is our price too high, Dr. Abelard Mavridis? The woman called out.
His mind raced as his worst fears were realized. He turned, determined to face her down. Someone has misled you.
We have our own intelligence.
He studied her kinesics warily. The wrinkles of her face were very slightly wrong,
not matching the muscles beneath the skin. "You're young," he said. "You only look old."
"Then we share one fraud. For you, that's only one of many."
"Ross told me you were dependable," he said. "Why risk your situation by annoying me?"
"We want the truth."
He stared. "How ambitious. Try the scientific method, and in the meantime, let's talk sense." The young woman smoothed her medical tunic with wrinkled hands.
"Pretend I'm a theater audience, Dr. Mavridis. Tell me about your ideology."
"I don't have one."
"What about the investor piece? All those detentiste plays? Did you think you would heal the schism with this investor fraud?"
"You're younger than I thought," he said. "If you ask me that, you must have never seen the war." She glared at him.
"We were raised in peace. Children told from the creche that love and reason would sweep the war aside. But we read history. Not Giuliano's version, but the bitter truth. Do you know what happens to groups whose innovations fail? At best, they're shuffled off to some wretched outpost. At worst, they're hunted down, picked off, turned against each other."
The truth of it stung him. "But some live." The girl laughed.
"You're unplanned, so why should you care for us? Stupidity is life and breath to you."
"You're one of Margaret Giuliano's people," he said. "The super brights." He stared at her. He had never met a super bright before. They were supposed to be closely sheltered, constantly under study.
"Margaret Giuliano," she said, "from your midnight clique. She helped design us. She's a detentiste. When the peace falls, we'll fall with her. They're always prying at us, spying, looking for flaws."
Her eyes were wild in the wrinkled face.
"Do you realize the potential we have? There are no rules, no souls, no limits. But dogmas hedge us in. False wars and stupid loyalties. The heaped-up garbage of the schismatrics. Others wallow in it, hiding from total freedom. But we want all the truth, without conditions. We take our reality raw. We want all eyes open, always. And if it takes a cataclysm, then we have 1,000 ready."
"No, wait," Lindsay said. The girl was a super bright. She could be no more than 30. It appalled him to see her so fanatic, so willing to repeat his errors, his and Vera's. "You're too young for absolutes. For God's sake, no pure gestures. Give it 50 years first. Give it 100. You have all the time you want."
"We don't think the way they want us to," the girl said. "And they'll kill us for it. But not until we've pried the world's skull open and put our needles in."
"Wait," Lindsay said. "Maybe the peace is doomed. But you can save yourselves. You're clever. You can—"
"Life's a joke, friend. Death's the punchline."
She raised her hand and vanished. Lindsay gasped. "What have you—" He stopped suddenly. His own voice sounded odd to him. The room's acoustics seemed different. The machines, however, were producing the same quiet hums and subdued beeps. He approached the machines. "Hello? Young girl? Let's talk first. Believe me, I can understand." His voice had changed. It had lost the subtle raspiness of age. He touched his throat left-handed. His chin had a heavy growth of beard. Shocked, he tugged at it. It was his own hair. He floated closer to the machines, touched one. It rustled beneath his hand. He seized it in a fury. It crumpled at once, showing a flimsy lathwork of cellulose and plastic. He tore into the next machine. Another mock-up. In the center of the complex was a child's tape recorder, humming and beeping faithfully. He snatched it up left-handed and was suddenly aware of his left arm, a lingering soreness in the muscle. He tore off his short and jacket. His stomach was taut, flat,
The graying hair on his chest had been painstakingly depilated. Again, he felt his face. He had never worn a beard, but it felt like 2 weeks' growth at least. The girl must have drugged him on the spot. Then someone had given him a cell wash, reversed catabolism, reset the Hayflick limit on his skin and major organs, at the same time exercising his unconscious body to restore muscle tone. Then, when all was done, replaced him in the same position and somehow restored him to instant awareness. Delayed shock struck him. The world seemed to shimmer. Compared to this, almost anything was easier to doubt. His name, his business here, his life. They left me the beard as the calendar, he thought dazedly. Unless that, too, was fraud. He took a deep breath. His lungs felt tight, stretched. They had stripped him of the tar from smoking. Oh, God, he said aloud. Nora! By now she would be past panic. She would be full of reckless hatred for whoever had taken him. He hurried at once to the bubble's exit. The grape-like cluster of cheap inflatables was hooked to an interurban tube road. He floated at once down the lacquered corridor and emerged through a filament doorway into the swollen transparent nexus of crossroads. Below was Goldreich Tremaine, with its Bezetzny and Patterson wheels spinning in slow majesty, with the molecule-like links and knobs of other suburbs shining purple, gold, and green, surrounding the city like beaded yarn. At least he was still in GT. He headed at once for home. Goldreich Tremaine Council State, 18-9-53. The chaos repulsed Constantine. Evacuations were untidy affairs. The docking port was littered with trash. Clothing, ship schedules, inhaler wrappers, propaganda leaflets. Baggage limits were growing stricter by the hour. Not far away, four shapers were pulling items from their overweight luggage and spitefully smashing them against the walls and mooring benches. Long lines waited at the interaction terminals. The overloaded terminals were charging by the second. Some of the refugees were finding that it cost more money to sell their faltering stocks than the stocks themselves were worth. A synthetic voice on the address system announced the next flight to Skimmer's Union. Instant pandemonium swept the port. Constantine smiled. His own craft, the Friendship Serene, had that destination. Unlike the others, his berth was secure, not simply in the ship, but in the new capital as well. Goldreich Tremaine had overreached itself. It had leaned too heavily on the mystique of its capital ship. When that was gone, seized by militants in a rival city, GT's web of credit had nothing to sustain it. He liked Skimmer's Union. It floated in circum-Titanian orbit, above the bloody glimmer of the clouds of Titan. In Skimmer's Union, the source of the city's wealth was always reassuringly close, the inexhaustible mass of rich organics that choked the Titanian sky. Fusion-powered dredges punched through its atmosphere, sweeping up organics by the hundreds of tons. Methane, ethane, acetylene, cyanogen. A planetary feedstock for the Union's polymer factories. Passengers were disembarking, a handful compared to those leaving, and not a savory handful. A group in baggy uniforms floated past customs. Sundogs, clearly, and not even shaper sundogs. Their skins shone with antiseptic oils. Constantine's bodyguards murmured to one another in his earpiece, sizing up the latest arrivals. The four guards were unhappy with Constantine's reluctance to leave. Constantine's many local enemies were close to desperation as Goldreich Tremaine's banks neared collapse. The guards were keyed to a fever pitch. But Constantine lingered. He had defeated the shapers on their own ground, and the pleasure of it was intense. He lived for moments like this one. He was perhaps the only calm man in a crowd of close to 2,000. Never had he felt so utterly in control. His enemies had been crippled by their underestimation. They had taken his measure and erred completely. Constantine himself did not know that measure. That was the pang that drove him on. He considered his enemies one by one. The militants had chosen him to attack the Midnight Clique, and his success had been thorough and impressive. Regent Charles Vetterling had been the first to fall. Vetterling fancied himself a survivor,
Encouraged by Carl Zoiner, he had thrown in his lot with the militants. The power of the Midnight Clique was broken from within. It splintered into warring camps. Those who held their ground were denounced by others more desperate. The mechanist defector Sigmund Fetzko had faded. These days, those calling his residence received only ingenious delays and temporizing from his household's expert system. Fetzko's image lived. The man himself was dead and too polite to admit it. Neville Pongpian School was dead, assassinated in the Republic at Constantine's order. Chancellor General Margaret Giuliano had simply vanished. Some enemy of her own had finished her. This still puzzled Constantine. On the day of her disappearance, he had received a large crate anonymously. Cautiously, opened by bodyguards, it had revealed a block of ice with her name elegantly chiseled on its surface. Margaret Giuliano, on ice. She had not been seen since. Colonel Professor Nora Mavrides had drastically overplayed her hand. Her husband, the false Lindsay, had disappeared, and she had accused Constantine of kidnapping him. When her husband returned again, with a wild tale about super-bright renegades and black market clinics, she was disgraced. Constantine was still not sure what had happened. The most likely explanation was that Nora Mavrides had been double-crossed by her burnt-out little cadre of diplomats. Probably they had seen what was coming and set up their one-time protectress, hoping that the new Skimmers Union regime would thank them for it. If so, they were grossly mistaken. Constantine looked about the cavernous station, adjusting his video shades for close-ups. Amid the fretting shapers and their over-elaborate finery was a growing minority of others. An imported cargo of sundogs. Here and there, shabbily clad ideological derelicts, their faces wreathed in smiles, were comparing lace-sleeved garments to their torsos, or lurking with predatory nonchalance beside evacuees lightening their luggage. "Vermin," Constantine said. The sight depressed him. "Gentlemen, it's time we moved on." The guards led him across the chained-off entry to a private ramp padded in Velcro. Constantine's cling-tight boots crunched and shredded across the fabric. He floated down the free-fall embarkation tube to the airlock of the Friendship Serene. Once inside, he took his favorite acceleration chair and plugged in on video to enjoy the takeoff. Within the port's skeletal gantryways, the smaller ships queued up for embarkation tubes, dwarfed by the stylized bulk of an investor starship. Constantine craned his neck, causing the hull cameras of the Friendship Serene to swivel in slaved obedience. "Is that investor ship still here?" he said aloud. He smiled. "Do you suppose they're hunting bargains?" He lifted his video shades. Within the ship's cabin, his guards clustered around an overhead tank, huffing tranquilizer gas from breathing masks. One looked up, red-eyed.
"May we go into suspension now, sir?"
Constantine nodded sourly. Since the war had started up again, his guards had lost all sense of humor. An investor trade ship. 22-9-53. Nora looked up at her husband, who sprawled above her in a towering chair. His face was hidden by a dark beard and opaque wraparound sunshades. His hair was close-cropped, and he wore a mech jumpsuit. His old, scarred diplomatic bag rested on the scratchy plush of the deck. He was taking it with him. He meant to defect. The heavy gravity of the investor ship weighed on both of them like iron. "Stop pacing, Nora," he said. "You'll only exhaust yourself."
"I'll rest later," she said. Tension knotted her neck and shoulders.
"Rest now. Take the other chair. If you'll close your eyes, sleep a little. In almost no time."
"I'm not going with you."
She pulled off her own sunshades and rubbed the bridge of her nose. The light in the cabin was the light investors favored. A searing blaze of blue-white radiance drenched in ultraviolet. She hated that light. Somehow she had always resented the investors for robbing her family's deaths of meaning, and the 3 months she'd once spent in a ship like this one had been the eeriest time of her life. Lindsay had been quick, adaptable,
the consummate sundog, as willing to deal with the aliens as he was with anyone. She'd wondered at it then, and now they had come full circle. He said, "You came this far. You wouldn't have if you didn't want to come with me. I know you, Nora. You're still the same, even if I've changed."
"I came because I wanted to be with you for every moment that I could."
She fought down the tears, her face frozen. The sensation was horrifying, a black nausea. Too many tears, she thought, had been pushed away for too long. The day would come when she would choke on them. Constantine used every weakness in Goldreich Tremaine, she thought. And my special weakness was this man. When Abelard came back from the rejuvenation clinic 3 weeks late and so changed that the household robots wouldn't let him in. But even that was not so bad as the days without him, hunting for him, finding that the black market subble he'd gone to had been deflated and put away, wondering what furtive star chamber was picking him to shreds.
"This is my fault," she said. "I accused Constantine with no proof, and he humiliated me. Next time I'll know better."
"Constantine had nothing to do with it," he said. "I know what I saw in that clinic. They were super brights."
"I can't believe in the cataclysts," she said. "Those super brights are watched like jewels. They don't have room for wild conspiracies. What you saw was a fraud. The whole thing was staged to draw me out, and I fell for it."
"Don't be proud, Nora. It's blinded you. The cataclysts abducted me, and you won't even admit they exist. You can't win because you can't bring back the past. Let it go and come with me."
"When I see what Constantine did to the clique..."
"It's not your fault. My God, aren't there disasters enough without your heaping them all on your own shoulders? Goldreich Tremaine is through. We have to live now. I told you years ago that it couldn't last, and now it's over."
He flung his arms wide. The left one, tugged by gravity, fell limply. The other whirred with smooth precision through a powered arc. They had been over this 100 times, and she saw that his nerves were frayed. Under the influence of the treatment, his hard-won patience had vanished in a blaze of false youth. He was shouting at her.
"You're not God. You're not history. You're not the Ring Council. Don't flatter yourself. You're nothing now. You're a target, a scapegoat. Run, Nora. Sundog it."
"The Mavridis clan needs me," she said.
"They're better off without you. You're an embarrassment to them now. We both are.
And the children?"
He was silent a moment. "I'm sorry for them. More sorry than I can say. But they're adults now, and they can take their own chances. They're not the problem here. We are. If we make things easy for the enemy, just slip away, evaporate, we'll be forgotten. We can wait it out."
"And give the fascists their way in everything? The assassins, the killers? How long before the belt fills up again with Shaper agents, and little wars blaze up in every corner?"
"And who'll stop that, you?"
"What about you, Abelard, dressed as a stinking mechanist, with stolen Shaper data in that bag? Do you ever think of anyone's life but your own? Why in God's name don't you stand up for the helpless instead of betraying them? Do you think it's easier for me without you? I'll go on fighting, but without you there'll be no heart in me."
He groaned. "Listen, I was a sundog before I met you. You know just how little I had. I don't want that emptiness, no one caring, no one knowing, and another betrayal on my conscience. Nora, we had almost 40 years. This place was good to us, but it's falling apart on its own. Good times will come again. We have all the time there is. You wanted more life, and I went out and got it for you. Now you want me to throw it away. I won't be a martyr, Nora, not for anyone."
"You always talked about morality," she said. "You're different now."
"If I changed, it was because you wanted me to."
"Not like this. Not treason."
"We'll die for nothing."
"Like the others," she said,
regretting it at once. And there it was before them,
the old guilt in all its stark intimacy, those others to whom duty was more than life, those they had abandoned, those they had killed in the Shaper outpost. That was the crime the two of them had struggled to efface, the crime that had bound them together.
Well, that's what you're asking, isn't it? To betray my own people again, for you.
There, she had said it. Now there was no going back. She waited in pain for the words that would free her from him.
You were my people, he said.
I should have known I would never have one for long. I'm a sundog, and it's my way, not yours. I knew you wouldn't come. He leaned his head against the bare fingers of his artificial arm. Piercing highlights glinted off the harsh iron.
Stay and fight, then. You could win, I think.
It was the first time he had lied to her.
But I can win, she said. It won't be easy. We won't have all we had, but we're not beaten yet. Stay, Abelard, please. Please, I need you. Ask me anything except to give up fighting.
I can't ask you to change, her husband said. People only change if you give them time. Someday this thing that's haunted us will wear away, if we both live. I think the love is stronger than the guilt. If it is, and someday you feel your obligations no longer need you, then come after me. Find me.
I will. I promise it, Abelard. If I'm killed like the others, and you live on safely, then say you won't forget me.
Never. I swear it by everything we had between us.
Goodbye, then.
She climbed up into the huge investor chair to kiss him. She felt his steel hand go around her wrist like a manacle. She kissed him lightly. Then she tugged, and he let her go.